So I'm gonna continue in what is apparently the theme of the fall, which is trying to use string theory to describe real life that isn't just stuff we're seeing in the sky or at the LHC, but actually trying to, in some way, shape, or form, describe condensed matter physics. It's a bit of a stretch, as we'll see, but I mean, there are surprising connections. We've heard already about kind of D3-D7 superfluid systems and things that look like Fermi surfaces, and we're going to see what look like superconductors using ADS-CFT. Most of this is based on recent work I did with Gary, though lots of stuff in here has been discussed over the past, I guess, year and a half as this kind of explosion of work has started. So what am I going to talk about? I'm going to start by just reminding everyone what a real superconductor is. And when I say superconductor, I really mean BCS superconductors. You just take a piece of metal, you get it very cold, and the resistivity vanishes. So that's really a reminder. And it's really a reminder for me because I'm really a string theorist and a gravitational physicist, not a condensed matter physicist, though I pretend to be one sometimes. Then I'm going to tell you what holographic superconductors are. Then we'll discuss what the conductivity is in these holographic systems. And we're going to see that it's just a simple reflection coefficient in terms of simple one-dimensional quantum mechanics scattering. And then we're going to start talking about extremal limits of the model. So what happens when you really take these systems to zero temperature? So what is BCS superconductivity? Well, it's a second-order phase transition. There's some critical temperature. As I said, you take a piece of metal, you get it very, very cold, and you notice that the DC resistivity gets smaller and smaller and smaller and vanishes at some critical temperature, and then it's just a perfect conductor. You also find the Meissner effect, which is that in the superconducting phase, it wants to expel any magnetic fields. The AC conductivity is gapped, and we know that's related to the fact that the spectrum is, in fact, gapped. There's a gap in the spectrum of states. And microscopically, this is described by electron pairings. There's some effective, attractive interaction between electrons, and that leads to an electron bilinear condensing. So what does the BCS theory look like? Well, it's just non-relativistic electrons. So we imagine we start out really just electrons on a square lattice. There's hopping. Electrons can hop from one site to another. There's a four-electron interaction, and there's some chemical potential which we turn on to get a finite density of electrons. And we've already seen this picture before, but you see that there's a Fermi surface. Since these are fermions and not bosons, they can't all just fill up the lowest energy state and get a Bose-Einstein condensate. So you get a Fermi surface. You fill up some shell of states. And when you fill up this shell of states, you see that your dispersion relation is massless because you see that excitation is just about the surface of the just about the Fermi surface are gapless. And you can also see, if you just do the one loop RG of this system, that if you start with repulsive interactions and you flow to the IR, they just get screened. That's not surprising because we're at finite density. But if you have an attractive interaction, it runs to a new fixed point. The coupling blows up, and we know that there has to be a different ground state. So what is this new state? You cool the system very low. There's some order parameter where now these are, I've done a Fourier transform, so these are creation operators for electrons of spin up and spin down. And this order parameter, delta, which is just built out of this fermion bilinear, is going to get a VeV and some new background. You write out the interacting Hamiltonian, we re-diagonalize it, and you see that there's a gapped dispersion relation where the gap is just this order parameter. And since now the fermionic quasi-particles are not really electrons because we've done some diagonalization of the creation and annihilation operators, there's some Bogoliubov transformation involved, but the quasi-particles are gapped, and so the low-energy effective theory just involves fluctuations of the order parameter and the electromagnetic field. It's just Landau-Ginzburg theory.
Sorry, what was C?
Oh, sorry. C was the dispersion relation in the original Hamiltonian, right? So C is just the energy in terms of the momentum. And so since we're looking at momenta right off the Fermi surface, it's gapless. But then we do the transformation in some new ground state, and it's gapped.
Okay.
So things I want to point out here, this is a theory where there's spontaneous breaking of a gauge symmetry. It's a real gauge electromagnetism that's spontaneously breaking. Now in ADS-CFT, that's very hard to do because in the gravity side, we can't easily access gauge degrees of freedom. But let me quickly remind you what ADS-CFT is. I think most people in this audience don't really need this reminder, but I had fun drawing this picture, so I'll talk about it. So ADS-CFT is a gauge gravity correspondence where you say that the partition function for some quantum field theory is exactly equal to the partition function for some string theory with boundary conditions, where the boundary conditions are anti-de Sitter space boundary conditions. And there's a limit of that string theory where it basically reduces to semi-classical gravity. And so the field theory partition function is related to just the on-shell action for the gravitational theory. The picture is as follows. You have some cylinder, and at the boundary of the cylinder, that's where your field theory lives. And the gravitational theory has one more direction. So the field theory directions are these xi and time. And in the gravity theory, there is an extra direction r. There can also be compact directions. We're not going to worry about that for now. And so if I want to calculate, say, a two-point function, I add a creation operator somewhere on the boundary here. It sources waves that go into the bulk. And then I measure it. The dagger should not be here, with some annihilation operator at some other position. And with that, I can measure two-point functions. And it's just related to propagation of classical fields in the bulk theory. And as we know, semi-classical gravity is taking the large n strongly coupled field theory limit. There are two approaches to ADS-CFT. The first is top-down, where you start with, for instance, a stack of ND3 brains in flat space, and you take the low energy effective low energy limit, and you get n equals 4 super Yang mills, and that's dual to type 2b string theory with ADS-5 cross S-5 boundary conditions. There's another approach where you just say, I'm going to pick some theory of gravity and hope in the back of my mind that there's some UV completion of it. I'm going to see what types of correlators and thermodynamic properties I can get out of some bulk gravitational theory that I really just make up. And what we really find is that we'll kind of cook up things that seem a little ad hoc, like a charged scalar with some mass in ADS-4, and then you wait a year and someone will realize that you can actually get this out of some actual supergravity construction. So what's the model we're going to look at? We're going to study Einstein, abelian, Higgs. So we're just going to have gravity with a negative cosmological constant, a U1 gauge field coupled to some charged scalar, psi. And psi has some potential. We're not going to worry about the details of it yet. Now, this is a bulk gauge field. So there's a gauge symmetry in the bulk. And gauge symmetries in the bulk tell you that you have a global symmetry on the boundary. Our goal here is to, in the bulk, spontaneously break this gauge symmetry, which will mean in the field theory that we're spontaneously breaking a global symmetry. Now remember that I said in real superconductors, in BCS theory, you're spontaneously breaking a gauge symmetry. That's just hard to do using ADS-CFT because you can't access gauge degrees of freedom with bulk descriptions. You can't calculate anything except gauge invariant quantities. So what are we going to start with? We're just going to assume that we have some static plane symmetric ansatz. It's just some metric. You have some electric potential turned on, some profile for the scalar hair. That's about as generic as it can get. The equations of motion, if we simplify by setting the ADS radius to 1, and we're just going to assume that psi is real. It's just this messy set of coupled nonlinear ODEs, and you can't solve it analytically. You can stare at it a while and hope you'll see something, but it's hard to get anything useful out of this other than known solutions, like just a charged black hole with no hair. Now, I should point out that in those equations of motion, there are two scaling symmetries. One of them we can use to shift chi to 0 at the boundary to know that we have asymptotically ADS-4 with the appropriately rescaled time coordinate, because chi just showed up as a redshift factor, essentially, in the metric. And the other one is we can rescale r. This is basically the conformal symmetry. We can either put the horizon at r equals 1 if we started with a horizon that was at a non-zero radius, Or we can also use it to just work in units of the chemical potential. That's the natural units to be working with anyways.
Can you show again the metric just so
sure. Sure. So the metric is, if this term weren't here and G was some known polynomial, it would just be, say, Reisner-Nordström ADS. Chi is just showing up as some extra redshift factor. The horizon is just going to be where G vanishes. And R is just labeling the size of our R2. And this, of course, generalizes to arbitrary dimensions. And basically, everything I'm going to discuss here should generalize to ADS5 or whatever you want to think about.
If you shift chi, doesn't that also shift A?
Yes, that's right. The scaling symmetry involves shifting chi, and then you have to also shift phi and t as well. It's just some rescaling of time. So these are the equation of motion. They're ugly. What are the asymptotics we want to have? Well, we want it to be asymptotically ADS. So that's just, this is ADS, there's a R squared dt squared and dr squared over R squared. And it's clear that you look at those asymptotics and there's a scaling symmetry. If I scale basically t and x, which I'm going to call the field theory directions, if I scale them with lambda and I scale R with 1 over lambda, the metric's invariant. Similarly, the electric potential, the leading order term, is going to tell me about the chemical potential in the dual theory. And the leading correction is going to tell me the charge density. And my scalar field psi has this standard. There are two fall-off terms because asymptotically it's just satisfying a linearized, it's a linear second-order equation, where lambda is some messy function of the mass. And since I was really working with a general potential, by mass I mean asymptotically I want psi to go to zero, and the mass is just the second derivative of the potential at the origin. And to be talking about spontaneously breaking this global symmetry, I want basically psi to get a VEV without being sourced. So in the same sense that I can think of the chemical potential as a source I turn on and the charge as the response, I can think of basically this as being a source for psi, which is dual to some charged operator in the field theory, and psi lambda to be the response.
So at this point, we don't know that V was the chemical potential. Is that a chemical potential in the dual theory?
It's a chemical potential in the dual theory. I know that if I look carefully at this equation and I, you know, basically calculate the chemical potential starting with the partition function, I can see that mu really is the chemical potential.
But in terms of being the energy of one more or less particle.
No, I only know it in terms of the thermodynamic definition.
You're saying you see a
μj0
there.
Yeah, there's a μj0. That's right. And so this is the game you basically play. You take the equation of motion I start with. You start with a Taylor expansion about some, say, regular horizon where all of the fields are regular, and G has a single zero, a first order zero, and you integrate out to large radius, and you tune your data on the horizon to try to find solutions that look like this. And I should point out that if your mass is between the BF bound and the BF bound plus one, there's a choice of quantization, but that's really not that important. The point is I have to be able to tune this to be zero for it to be a solution that's talking about spontaneously breaking my symmetry. So what is the one nice analytic solution we know that's asymptotically ADS? Well, it's Reisner-Nordström. I could just turn the scalar field off. I set chi to zero, which is just saying minus GTT is GRR. And this is the solution. You can see from looking at this and what I had on the previous slide that mu is now basically equal to rho. That's not always going to be true. It's just true in this solution. And the metric just has some ugly formula, where here I've rescaled things so that the horizon is at r equals 1. You can easily just look at this. You set r equal to 1. You see that's 0. I can also ask, what's the temperature of this black hole? And the temperature of the black hole is just going to be the temperature of the dual theory. There's some nice formula for the temperature of the black hole you can get by just calculating a surface gravity. And you see that it has this following form. So there's an extremal limit if I crank up the chemical potential, or equivalently the charge, too much, keeping the horizon at r equals 1, which I can think of as just working in chemical potential in units of energy or something. And there's some limit when mu squared is 12. I find zero temperature. G has now a second order zero. Phi takes some uninteresting value. And if you look at this, you realize that R is basically about 1. And what that really means is that I have an ADS2 cross R2 solution in the deep infrared, at the horizon, essentially. And so we can think of ADS4 Reisner-Nordström as an RG flow. Tom told us about this, I guess, last week. So this is my very crude picture of ADS4 Reisner-Nordström. At large radius, you just have ADS4, which is dual to a 2 plus 1 UV CFT. And if we look at, say, fluctuations of our charged scalar in that background, this is with no time or x dependence, this is the wave equation they satisfy. But deep in the infrared, we see that we get ADS2 cross R2, which really tells us that we have something that looks like a 0 plus 1 CFT. Maybe it's a family of CFTs labeled by momenta on R2. That's not too important. The important thing to notice is that I look at this wave equation and I can identify this as the effective mass for fluctuations of the scalar field. When I'm deep in the infrared throat, I see that I now have some new effective mass that, first of all, gets shifted because in this infrared, the cosmological constant in ADS2 is just different from the cosmological constant of ADS4 because we have some constant electric field turn on, and that contributes. We also have a contribution basically from the charged background, because you remember that this was a charged scalar field. And we basically have this term in its equation of motion, and that adds that Q squared term. But we should remember that you can have tachyonic mass fields in ADS, but they can't be too tachyonic or it's unstable. So in fact, in ADS2, if that effective mass is below the Breitlohner-Freeman bound in ADS2, which is minus a quarter, then it's unstable. And what does that mean? That means pictorially that down here, the scalar field is unstable and wants to blow up, but out here it's stable. So what's the reasonable endpoint that you might suspect will happen? Well, there'll be some lower energy solution where out here I just have nice, you know, some fall off of the scalar field, but deep in the infrared throat there's some big profile for the scalar field turned on. And once it's turned on, it's going to back react, and I may or may not really have ADS2 cross R2 anymore in the throat. So pictorially, if we plot this, we have some mass squared parameter and the charge. Where is it unstable? Well, there's a lower bound in ADS4. The mass squared can't get below 9/4, or even in the ADS4 region, the system is unstable. And then this is the line just saying that there is an instability in the ADS2 throat. And I've written this as two overlapping sections because I'm writing this in terms of the mass squared, but I really should plot this in terms of the dimension of the dual operator. And then I see that this just unfolds and I have two halves. There's some lower bound, the unitary bound on the dimension of the operator, and there's just some regime. As I crank up the charge, any operator is going to be unstable if I make it charged enough. And so we want to know, in this regime, we know that ADS4 Reisner-Nordström is just not a stable ground state. So what is the stable ground state? And that's what we're going to try to find out for at least some regions of this diagram.
What are the two regions?
It's just that if I plot it in terms of m squared, there's an overlap because there are really two solutions. When between the BF bound and the BF bound plus 1, there are two types of normalizable falloff. Really, there's an infinite family I can take, you know, generic linear, nonlinear combinations of it, but we'll stick to this for now. It's easier. So what do we get at the end of this instability? We get some sort of black hole with hair, and it's hard to draw a picture of what a black hole with hair looks like, but I can try to plot for you some of those metric and metric functions and the fields in this background. So this is a plot of, say, G, which is this green line, and chi, which is this dashed line, and as the color goes from bright to black, that's cooling the system down. And so what's happening, you see that generically chi gets very big near the horizon, which is now moving to be towards r equals 0. G is doing something uninteresting, but at large radius it again goes as r squared plus subleading corrections, and chi is going to 0 as it has to be. For phi and psi, you see that phi is now the green line, and it's just picking up some big non-trivial profile near the origin and then falls off in the appropriate power law. And phi is actually suppressed in this throat region basically because of the redshift factor. And at large radius, it has some fall off. That's just mu minus rho over r.
Could you remind us of all these things? Phi is the gauge potential, A0.
Yeah,
right?
Phi is the electric potential in the ball.
And
psi is just the charged scalar field on the ball.
So psi is the scalar field.
Yeah, psi is the scalar field. Phi is the electric potential.
Okay.
And I just wanted to put this picture up here so you have some sort of idea of what we expect things to look like. The charged scalar and the redshift factor chi get big near the origin, and phi and g both vanish there. Well, g has to vanish.
If you wanted to, you could increase the TC of this thing by changing your mass squared parameter of
these
charges.
Yeah.
Completely independently of anything else.
Which
is different from what people find in the real
world. Yeah, that's right. I mean,
sorry, don't you just have mu and the mass of the scalar field is not.
Sure, the critical temperature, since it's a conformal theory, the critical temperature is some number times mu. But what that number is totally tunable by these parameters.
Oh,
right, because if you make m squared small enough, then it only sets in a...
That's right, right. I mean, this line here and this little line here are the lines of marginal stability. The further inside that region I am, the more room there is from TC to T equals 0. That's all.
So from this point of view, the correlation between high TC superconductors and strange metals and whatnot is completely unclear. I mean, field theory doesn't by itself say that there should be such a correlation, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that statement. I mean, yeah, at the moment, this is just, I mean, lambda and Q aren't parameters in the Lagrangian of the CFT that I can tune,
well,
right?
Well, they are if you believe your philosophy of phenomenology and looking.
Well, no, I mean, changing this is really changing the CFT. It's not adding some extra term to the Lagrangian in the CFT. It's really changing the dynamics. I change phi, I'm changing the dimension of the operator. That's not adding an extra
term.
I'm
just saying it's analogous to changing the material you're studying.
Yeah, that's a fair way to look at it. I'm just completely changing the system, and for some reason, things look similar.
It's a Dennehy Hartle made a plot of the different values for some set of the loose creature limits.
Yeah.
But those are just specific examples.
Yeah, but even forgetting the embedding string theory, I'm not sure you could make, you know, so this critical temperature, as Matt says, is always proportional to mu. I don't think that coefficient can be made arbitrarily large, because, you know, to maximize the instability here, you'd want to let m squared be as negative as possible, and Q to be as big as possible to get the long charge. But if Q is very large, you're in what we call the probe limit. And in the probe limit, with m squared equal to the Breitner-Friedman bound, you still get a nice finite TC.
That's true,
So there's some, you know, it's only some number of order one. It doesn't grow arbitrarily high in terms of the chemical potential.
I think that's right, though. I'm not entirely sure, because there's a rescaling of phi when you take the probe limit. And so there are factors of Q in there that I'm not 100% certain of, but I think you're right.
Check that.
So you have black holes with hair. So really, we want these to be superconductors, so we have to figure out how to calculate the conductivity. From linear response theory, we know that the conductivity is related to a retarded Green's function that's just a two-point function of my current operators. So very explicitly, I see that the retarded Green's function is just some Fourier transform. I mean, I've done a Fourier transform of some commutator of current operators. And moreover, we know that there's a spectral density that's related to this Green's function that's basically telling us about the density of energy eigenstates. That's why we say in the actual BCS theory, when there's a gap in the AC conductivity, we know that the spectrum of states is gapped. It's explicitly because of this, right? We know that we're looking at the imaginary part of a Green's function. The optical theorem tells us that what's contributing to this is all of the intermediate states that can interact. So let me.
This is for omega going to zero, or?
No, this is just. Sorry, this should be as a function of omega, right? This is just the AC conductivity. I can take the limit to get the DC conductivity, right? But so I see that the conductivity, the real part of the conductivity, is related to the density of charged states.
Stable, so
you
know, and then you just add a little bit of A naught. Doesn't that kick it over to be unstable?
So you're at the Breitner-Friedman bound with what? Is there a neutral field or a charge field? Or?
Well, no, the field, let's say, was charged, and now I'm changing, now I'm taking into account the fact that the charge couples it to the background anode in the bulk.
That's right, but even a neutral scalar, if you have a mass that's if the mass of the scalar field is low enough, even at Q equals zero, right? Even at Q equals zero, these scalar fields are unstable in the ADS2 throat. So you have to have an ADS2 throat for them to be unstable. They're not unstable in ADS4, of course.
Okay, but suppose you start with something that's stable in ADS4.
Yep.
Barely.
Yeah, I mean that's this guy here.
Yeah, and then you turn on a.
A little bit of chemical potential. Then you expect
it. That grows toward the IR, so at some point, you know, let's say you start with a little bit of buffer to stability, and then at some point the state off grows.
I mean, that's right. And if you're really working at zero temperature, you turn on a little bit of chemical potential, and you know that that means I'm going to have to flow to ADS2 in the throat, so it's going to be unstable.
And you flow at a higher and higher scale, right?
Yeah.
So I'm still confused by why you don't get visibility if you can tune to be at a higher and higher scale.
Let's talk about this afterwards.
I mean, the key to resolving this discussion is the definition of the chemical potential. You have to be careful in defining it in the same way in the probe limit and when you're not in the probe limit. There are factors of Q floating around where you rescale fields and so forth. If you're careful with that, you'll get some consistent answer. I just don't know exactly what it is at the moment.
Okay.
Right. So we're calculating the conductivity. It's just a two-point function for the current operators. And linear response theory, if this was a gauge U1, this would literally be measuring the response. I turn on an electric field, and what is the current response in the theory, in the medium? But I mean, at the level of linear response theory, it doesn't really matter whether this is a global or a gauge U1 current. I'm just turning on a current source, and I'm feeling the response. So how do we do this? Well, we know basically from the boundary on-shell action that there's a coupling AX to JX. So if we want to calculate sigma XX, for instance, we want to study linearized AX fluctuations. Since we want to calculate a retarded Green's function, we know that we have to look at fluctuations that are ingoing boundary conditions at the horizon. And so you just work out what the wave equation for that is in the bulk, where all of these primes denote R derivatives. I'm assuming some e to the minus I omega t dependence of AX, and that's it. So this is just some messy equation. And so what you do, I mean, what was originally done was you just take this, you solve it numerically, you get these plots of the conductivity that appear to have a gap in them. You solve this, and then you want to say, well, I actually want to get the Green's function, and you just use the ADS-CFT dictionary. From the large radius asymptotics of AX, you basically know that the conductivity is related to the ratio of the subleading term to the leading order term.
Actually, in the boundary theory, normally that gap would come from the fact that you really
Higgs
the gauge field, and the two pair up and get a mass.
That's exactly right. And there isn't a Higgs, and there needs to be a Goldstone mode. And we'll find that there's a Goldstone mode.
Even if it's a Goldstone mode,
yeah,
you're finding your gap at leading order and large end.
Yep.
And I think there's one Goldstone mode. So why would it show up at leading order and large end? That would be a 1/n correction. So it can't just be a Goldstone.
That's right. Yeah. It isn't. And it's really an infinite DC conductivity.
That's why we thought for almost a year that the conductivity would strictly go to zero.
Yeah.
At zero temperature, because we thought, okay, well, there's this Goldstone mode. There's only one.
Exactly.
That,
When you find it doesn't, what's your explanation
gonna be? Well, it's a strong, I mean, you can wave your hands and say it's a strongly interacting theory. If there's some Goldstone mode, it's interacting, so that's gonna fill in that space in the spectral density. I don't know.
I'm making up ends with that. It's suspicious.
I agree. Okay. This is a really messy thing. Let's see how many of these terms we can eliminate, mostly by just doing redefinitions. If we write this, it was just a second-order linear differential equation. If we write it as a Schrodinger equation, we can use all of our nice intuition from 1D quantum mechanics to at least be able to draw pictures and have a better idea in terms of bulk physics of what's going on. So we switch to what are essentially infalling coordinates, some new radial coordinate z written in terms of r and metric functions, and the wave equation reduces to something very nice. It's just Schrodinger's equation where the energy is now omega squared. And this potential has two contributions. One is from the electric field, and one is from the scalar hair. So that's not surprising. So what we're going to imagine doing is we're going to, you know, look at fluctuations of this field, and there's going to be potential basically from the scalar field and from the electric field. Now, at large radius, this equation here just reduces to something very simple. I mean, even I can do this integral analytically, and you see that z basically goes as 1 over r. And since g has to vanish at least linear at the horizon, for there to be a horizon, you know that at the horizon is at z equals minus infinity. So let's draw a picture of this. We actually know better from the asymptotics of psi and phi that asymptotically the potential takes the following form. This is the contribution from the electric field, which vanishes at the boundary. There's some contribution from the scalar hair that may or may not vanish at the boundary.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
You said really quickly that g has to vanish linearly?
At least linearly.
Oh, at least linearly, okay. I mean, so we know that it has to be at least that fast. There aren't a lot of, I mean, non-standard examples where g vanishes with very strange and black and black.
I mean, if it's a black hole.
Yeah, it has to vanish at least first order.
With a smooth horizon.
Yeah.
Well, then a lot of these things have singular horizons next to them, right?
Yeah, well, so that's... So in fact, we didn't assume, well, when Matt talks about externality, we didn't assume anything.
Okay. Yeah, so sure. So you could maybe cook something up where it vanishes less quickly in some, you know, null singularity or something, but right. I'm not sure. But basically, this is the picture. We're doing quantum mechanics, and let's assume for now it's going to be true that, you know, down at the horizon the potential vanishes. Then all we're doing is we're doing a scattering problem. I imagine extending my domain of z. Originally went from minus infinity to zero, but I can just extend it all the way to plus infinity with just a flat potential. So I imagine I come in with some incident wave. I'll normalize it to be one. There's some potential. The potential can either actually blow up at z equals zero, or it can be finite, or it can vanish. It doesn't matter. You can look at the power of this. This only happens when lambda is between a half and one, and you can still tunnel through that. So you send in some wave, there's a potential, some of it gets reflected, some of it gets transmitted, and this business about ingoing boundary conditions is just the fact that we only have a transmitted wave. And this is just quantum mechanics, right? You just open up that textbook that you probably haven't, I hadn't opened up in a while, and you see how to do these problems. And I'll come back to this, the fact that I drew the potential as vanishing down at the horizon later. Sorry, the boundary is at z equals zero. You see that the term coming from the scalar hair may or may not blow up. But even if it does blow up, it's you can check the WKB approximation and see that you can still tunnel through it. So there's just some sharp, skinny wall that you can bounce.
Real exponentials there.
Yeah, right. So you're exponentially suppressing here. So you're some oscillating. Well, I guess that's the next picture. We'll just go to it, right?
You're oscillating in real time.
Yeah, I'm oscillating in real time, so this is a crude picture, but I have some potential barrier. If I'm at a very high frequency, I just scale over, I just fall straight through. If I'm at very low frequencies, I hit this potential barrier, and I'm basically exponentially suppressed for most of it until maybe I get through it somewhere, and there's some slow oscillation there. Right? But remember that I started with some ingoing wave, and there's some reflection, reflected wave. So I go through my calculation for what the conductivity is, and I get this surprisingly simple-looking result, that the conductivity is just some simple formula in terms of the reflection coefficient. Right. So what's happening? If I'm at a very, very high frequency, then the reflection coefficient, then I just sail over, there's no reflection, and I just get a sigma equals 1.
You had a potential that, in some cases, just went to infinity, and the yeah. solutions to those sort of on the right side of this picture are not oscillating at all.
That's right. I mean, this is...
By
reflection coefficient, I mean, I imagine having extended the domain of z to be positive, and so I start over here with some incoming wave, comes in, and it hits here. If this is finite, there's a discontinuity, but...
The potential just be infinite.
It's infinite, yeah. It does seem a little funny, but it's
also true.
Let's go. All right. So let's have some actual examples of what these potentials look like. Again, red curves are near the critical temperature. Black curves are as we've cooled the system down. And what happens? OK, so here's one example.
One
yeah, yeah.
in your previous transparency, your formula for sigma,
yep,
in d dimensions, that changes in an important way or not?
Sure. In d dimensions, it's going to be slightly
different. T to the d in front of it, or t to the whatever d minus 3, or what's...
I don't know. In d dimensions, there has to be some omega dependence, because it's only in the 2 plus 1 CFT that the large frequency conductivity goes to 1.
Right.
So this won't not depend on omega in other dimensions, I'm sure. The fact that it did it here, I was very surprised.
Yeah. Well, it has different dimensions.
Yeah. But I don't know if it'll work out. There'll just be some omega to the d minus 2 in front or something, or there'll be more omega.
The question is whether there's a function in the multiple
thing. Yeah. Yeah. That would be really nice if that's all it was.
Right.
But that's something that I should just sit down and check. Okay, so examples of this potential. Well, if we imagine that the charge of the scalar here is very, very large, you remember that there was a q squared in the potential, and so as we cool the system down, we get bigger and bigger hair. The potential grows very, very dramatically. And this is really explaining that apparent gap in the conductivity. Here's another example. If q is only 1, potential doesn't really shift much at all. And this is actually seen in some of these in calculations. When q was 1, you looked at plots of the conductivity, and it really didn't look like a hard gap. So the key thing to take away from this slide is that whether or not you get a big, big growth in the potential or not really has to do with q more than anything else. It's just that factor of q squared and the potential. Okay. Now, as I told you before, I assumed in all of those pictures I drew that the Schrodinger potential vanished on the horizon. You can actually show this using the equations of motion. It's independent of what the actual potential for the scalar is. It doesn't matter whether or not the horizon is at r equals 0 or at some finite radius. It's reasonably generic. It's probably even more robust than this. Basically, the point is that to have a non-zero Schrodinger potential on the horizon means that the scalar field must be doing something very big. And generically, Einstein's equations tell you the Bach reaction of that makes G vanish quickly enough that the Schrodinger potential has to vanish on the horizon. This is a surprisingly robust thing. And I should go back and say that if we really wanted to get a hard gap, we would need the potential to not vanish on the horizon. Right? If the potential really didn't vanish on the horizon, then for frequencies below that infrared value of it, you would always be exponentially suppressed. And there would be it would be all real reflection coefficient.
So would that match the DC result correctly?
Zero is zero.
The point is that analytically what we're going to find is that even when the Schrodinger potential vanishes at the horizon, the omega equals zero, the real part of the conductivity vanishes as omega goes to zero. Yes, there'll be a delta function as well. You always get a delta function whenever this potential is non-zero, even if it has a tiny one. That's why even in the Reisner-Nordström background, if you take into account back reaction, you see that there's a delta function.
You literally get a zero just by putting in a hard gap, right? If you did this in a dual mode theory with mass gap.
Sorry, you mean if I didn't have a horizon?
Yeah, I mean, then you
sure,
have
okay,
a horizon
but if I don't have a horizon, I don't have a horizon. The theory just has a discrete spectrum.
So you can get conductors trivially. Insulators.
You can get insulators trivially, but I mean, everything will be gapped,
yeah.
Right?
So the question is whether you can get heat conduction without charge conduction.
Yes.
And you're saying you can't.
Not in these models, you can't. Yeah, that's right. Because to have heat conduction, you have to have the background temperature turned on. Or you have to have a horizon. All right. So, let's see. At finite temperature, you have a first order of zero in G. So the potential goes as E to the sum constant times Z. When the potential goes as E to the sum constant times Z, that vanishes quickly enough at the horizon that you can actually get a non-zero real part of the conductivity as omega goes to zero. Right? But this is what the plots look like. I mean, this is a toy model I cooked up quickly in Mathematica, but this is essentially what the plots of the conductivity looked like when we did the numerics. You see that as you cool the system, this really seems to be going down to zero. And even over here, it seems to be going down to zero. So the question is there really a hard gap here or not? So what about the extremal limit? How does the Schrodinger potential behave? Well, we want to know about the conductivity, right? The Schrodinger equation, of course, has a conserved flux, so it's independent of z. Now, near the boundary, you can calculate this conserved flux, and you see that it's related to the real part of the conductivity. Right? So using matched asymptotic expansion will let us find out what the at least the real part of the conductivity is in a series expansion about small frequency. Well, let's consider the Schrodinger potential going as some constant over z squared, and I can motivate this by saying that this is what happens in all of the extremal limits we look at. I'm not sure why is what happens in all of the cases we looked at. It surprised me, because we get very interestingly different results. Well, if you look at a potential that looks like this, well, deep, you know, in the horizon region, you have some infalling solution that's described by a Hankel function. You see that the Hankel, this behavior is only a function of omega times z. So if the derivative with respect to z vanishes, the derivative with respect to omega vanishes. So f is independent of the frequency in this limit of small frequency. So the only frequency dependence left is in the leading order behavior of a of x. Using matched asymptotics, you see it goes as omega to the minus nu. And at the end of the day, this is the important result, that you find the real part of the conductivity goes as omega to the delta, where delta is just some function of this coefficient of the potential. So there's never a hard gap if this is the fall off you get. You can just see that you can WKB tunnel through this at any very small frequency.
Well, let me ask just a stupid question, which is if you just evaluated the integral dz, what square root of b of z,
yeah,
which would have naively been your WKB suppression factor,
yeah,
it looks just borderline divergent here.
Yeah.
It looks log divergent. What is it that compensates for that divergence? I mean, is it WKB breaks down at very, very large z? Or?
Yeah.
No, it's just a statement that it will diverge at omega, yeah, equals zero. Omega is incident energy.
Yeah.
Well, precisely when omega equals zero.
So omega equals zero, it vanishes, and that's consistent with this power law behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. So any positive omega, you don't think
you can think. Now, I could just think about other potentials and see what type of answers I get. I mean, I could just think of this as a quantum mechanics problem. If you, for instance, look at just some V naught over Z, then the WKB amplitude really diverges. You really can't tunnel through it. If you actually do this analytic calculation, you see that there still isn't a hard gap. But instead of having some nice behavior like this, there's some really ugly non-analytic suppression, some e to the minus 1 over omega or something really, really nasty. It's just in this case that I get some nice power law type of behavior.
And everything is smooth in this whole calculation throughout, including that region
kind of. Well, there's a delta function, right? The imaginary part is going to have a pole by Kramer's Kronig relation. Any corrections to the background?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean just the background solution?
Yeah.
Oh, in most of the zero temperature limits, we're going to find there are really actually null singularities and so forth. So,
okay, so
there are divergent curvatures and so forth. You might worry about
it. Is there a possibility that effectively kicks up this potential?
Sure, it is. But it's hard to imagine what would happen. I mean, really, this issue of never a hard gap really seems to physically come from the fact that even if you have some big potential barrier, you still have something like a horizon, even if it's a horizon at, you know, a null singularity where the horizon is. And if you have a horizon, any small bit of frequency can tunnel through, even if it'll be very, very suppressed by going through some big potential barrier. But it seems reasonably generic that you'll still be able to tunnel through. But issues of corrections to the gravitational solution, I don't really know.
You're saying what you'd need is something that was really just an infinite potential.
Yeah, you need, well, it doesn't need to be infinite. It just needs to not go to zero. Basically,
oh.
If it was just a little more divergent than WKB, it might even work. And you all found this marginal case.
Yeah.
But you said you can't be able to tunnel through.
Even if the WKB tunneling amplitude seems to diverge, you can get this could not look like this, but it'll be some non-analytic thing vanishing at omega equals zero. For instance, it could look like e to the minus 1 over omega or something. That could be how it vanishes. It could be very nasty. But you'll still get that there's not a hard gap. If you really explicitly evaluate it at omega not zero.
You want a gap, meaning you want some range of frequencies. For
yes, I want some finite range where it's really honestly zero. That would make me a lot happier.
And for that to happen, you need a potential.
No, I
need the potential to be non-zero on the horizon.
At the horizon.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So you need the
the scalar field needs to be blowing up in some much worse way than Einstein's equation seemed to allow for it to do.
Right.
Yeah.
If you now ask at zero temperature and also try to go to zero frequency, there's this order of limits issue. So you're working in the limit where omega over t goes to infinity.
Yes, when I say that this is the form of the potential at the horizon here, I'm already working with the zero temperature solution, and I'm looking at finite frequency. So I've already taken the t goes to zero limit, and then I'm looking at omega going to zero. Okay, so zero temperature infrared solutions, that's what we really need to study to try to understand this small frequency behavior. Also because it would be nice to know what the low temperature limit of these hairy black holes is. But we can't always find an exact infrared fixed point like we did for ADS2, right? For ADS2 across S2 with some finite amount of charge, that's an exact solution to those equations of motion I wrote down. We'll at some point at least find leading order behavior of the metric in fields near the horizon, and then there's just some Taylor expansion. So for now, we're just going to consider a simple potential, just a mass term, nothing more than that. And I'm going to point out now, so I don't have to say it each time I present something, in all of the cases we find, there's zero horizon area, and there's zero charge on the horizon, except in the one case where, of course, if the charge of the scalar field is zero, if it's really not a charged scalar field, then if there's charge, the charge has to be on the horizon. But whenever the charge of the scalar field is non-zero, the horizon isn't going to carry any charge. If it carried any charge, you would expect that it would want to pair produce charged fields. So the first and easiest case, well, maybe not the easiest case, the case where it's just a marginal deformation, so it's a massless scalar field. You can see that a nice solution to the leading order equation near the horizon is as follows. Basically, phi almost goes as r squared. It has some kink in it. Alpha is some number between minus 0.1 and 0.1 or so. Psi approaches some constant, and then it has a correction. Chi is a constant on the horizon. And g goes as r squared plus corrections. So what does this mean? It means that, again, we have ADS4 in the infrared, right? It has some shifted cosmological constant. It doesn't have a shifted cosmological constant. This is just r squared. It's just ADS in the infrared, and there's some non-trivial profile for the scalar field, and the electric potential has responded for it. These are charged static solitons. They're not actually C infinity because alpha isn't a nice integer. There's some, if you tune Q just so, there is some case where alpha is exactly zero, but generically it's not.
Is there any potential? There's no mass.
No, there's no mass. The entire V of psi is just zero. There's no potential. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
If you do tune alpha to an integer, might you get a log?
No, I don't think so. No, you just get, if alpha is exact, in the solution where alpha is zero, do you get a log? No, you don't. It's just a perfectly C infinity solution. And it's just about somewhere, it's right here or so. It's some uninteresting value of Q. Now, if you remember on the plots I showed you before, when the mass squared is zero, there's some lower bound on Q for when there's actually an instability deforming hair. That's this dashed line here. And this is just a plot of what alpha is for various values of Q. It does some uninteresting thing. Okay, it goes from maybe minus 0.05 to 0.3. Uninteresting, it never gets very big, so you don't have to worry about that causing singularities. You study what that solution looked like near the infrared, and you see that the Schrodinger potential gives you a delta that looks like this. It's uninteresting, it's about 4. This is what the solution looks like. G hasn't changed too much. It's actually, in this case, this is a plot where Q is probably about 1 or something. So G actually looks a lot like the Reisner-Nordström solution. As you take Q to this limiting value of the square root of 3 over 2, the solution actually just has to turn into Reisner-Nordström, so G would actually come down, touch, and have an actual zero here. This is where the extremal Reisner-Nordström horizon would be. And the scalar field is just some uninteresting profile of scalar hair that's essentially entirely hidden behind where this horizon wants to be. Now, the nice thing about this is that this is just some analytic calculation that we did. But a group in Tokyo actually calculated the conductivity numerically and saw that we were right, which was nice because I didn't want to do that calculation. So Konoplia and Zdenko actually just did this calculation for two cases here. There's a massless case, Q equals 1, Q equals 0.6. And this is the important plot. This is a log-log plot of the conductivity as a function of frequency. And you see that at small frequency, it has the appropriate slopes.
Why is there disconductivity at 0.4?
This is a bigger picture of the conductivity. And I think what's happening here is that this is the small frequency regime where this power law fits. And this is a different approximation they did, matching solutions in an expansion about infinite frequency. Right, so here you just know that it gets a tiny deformation from the potential. And they see that these things match pretty well. Oh. Now that solution I showed you there's a similar solution when you have a W-shaped potential. So I imagine if I don't just have a mass term, but I have some generic potential for the scalar field, then I say that my infrared solution sits at some new extremum of the potential where there's some value of the potential at the extremum, and psi takes some psi 0. And what do you get? Well, it's just going to be, again, ADS4 with some shifted. Now it has a shifted value of the cosmological constant, of course, because the potential is now non-zero. It's exactly shifted by that. This is a formula for delta. This is really the type of infrared fixed points you find in any of these models that you get out of a supergravity construction. Generically, if you try to cook something like this up out of supergravity, you're never just going to get a mass squared term at the potential. You get some complicated thing, and it usually will have some second extremum here, and that's what was found by Steve Gubser and his students and other people, and Toby Wiseman, and et cetera. But that was a nice, smooth solution, except for this, you know, mild discontinuity and derivatives of curvature at the at the origin. Now, there's another place where we can actually study this analytically, which is where if the charge is big enough, then we know that this happens to be a reasonable near horizon ansatz. Finding these is really a matter of trial and error. You stare at the equations, you realize you can't find any exact solutions. You do a lot of numerics to try to get plots of what the functions are doing as you cool the system lower and lower and lower, and then you start guessing, and on the millionth try, you get something that works. It's a pain to do. The important thing to take away from this solution is that if I use some rescaled radial coordinate, the infrared solution has a nice new, it restores Poincaré symmetry in the infrared. There's no scale symmetry anymore, but I have Poincaré symmetry restored. There's just some e to the minus r squared factor in front of the field theory directions. And again, delta has some messy looking formula. It's always greater than 2 in this case because of this requirement here. And again, you can see that these solid lines are numerics, where we just took the system at finite temperature, cooled it down. And I say that as if I was really doing this in a lab or something, but it's all just Mathematica. And you see that it matches very nicely onto doing numerics, starting with our zero temperature ansatz and integrating out. It matches very nicely. This is an example where m squared is minus 2, so lambda is 2 and q is 10. But it works, and it's important to see that it really does agree. Because you could imagine, for instance, that you find some new infrared fixed point, but it's just not the one that the cold temperature limit of the black hole is actually connected to. Right? I mean, I could always stare at those equations and say, hey, ADS2 cross S2 is a solution. It's just not the one with any hair. There's one other case we'll look at. If you have a positive mass squared for your scalar field, you see that Lifshitz is an exact solution. And by Lifshitz, I just mean that GTT goes as r to the 2z, where z is just some number greater than 1. GRR goes as r squared. There's some formula for z in terms of the mass squared and the charge. And you can work out what these coefficients are. And this is now actually an exact solution. This isn't a series expansion solution. So to actually connect this to ADS4, I'd have to find some subleading, possibly non-analytic corrections, use them as a shooting parameter to numerically integrate out. It's very hard, though, because this is a positive mass squared field. What it really wants to do as you do this numerical integration is get very big and completely destroy the ADS4 asymptotics because it's an irrelevant operator.
Well, you can just study this as a UV theory.
Yeah, you could also just study this at the UV theory. The very, very surprising thing, and I had to check this a lot of times until I really convinced myself that it was right, is you calculate delta for this Lifshitz throat, and you see that delta is 2. Doesn't matter what M is, doesn't matter what Q is, it's completely independent of Z. And this result is actually independent of what the scalar potential is, other than making sure it's a scalar potential that admits Lifshitz as a solution. Not any generic potential will admit Lifshitz as a solution. There's a little bit of a constraint. It basically boils down to the constraint that Shamet had in his paper, where the cosmological constant has to be tuned to something as a function of Z.
This isn't really scale invariant because of the e to the chi, right? No, what am I saying?
No, GTT is r to the 2z. It really is just Lifshitz.
And
phi goes as r to the z, so the phi squared is, yeah. It is really Lifshitz. Nothing breaks it. Yeah, yeah, because the scalar field is just a constant. Yes, it really is exactly Lifshitz. It's not spontaneously broken by anything, or it's not broken by any field. However, I need to point out, as nice as that was, if you study linearized fluctuations of that background in the same sense as you might study linearized fluctuations of a scalar field with some arbitrary mass squared in an ADS background, so you just work out what the linearized fluctuations is with some alpha sub psi. Alpha sub psi is always complex when the charge and the mass squared allow for an instability of Reisner-Nordström. Now, if this was ADS, we'd really know that this meant that this is actually unstable. It's not ADS, it's the Lifshitz solution. So we don't really have these nice rigorous theorems telling us that this means that there's an instability. But our intuition from ADS says that when you look at fluctuations and have complex dimension, that really means there something's unstable. And this is whenever Q and M allow for there being an instability of Reisner-Nordström. If this is an instability, then it really makes you wonder, what is the endpoint to the instability for Reisner-Nordström wanting to have hair when the scalar field is massive? The real problem here is that doing numerics, as I said, with a positive mass squared scalar field is just very hard because, right, there are two directions. You do numerical integration, you have two boundary conditions. You have the boundary of ADS and you have the horizon. If you start with the boundary of ADS and you try to integrate inwards, generically for generic, you know, values of data at infinity, you're just going to integrate inwards and hit some naked singularity. Similarly, if you try to integrate outwards and you have a positive mass squared, this irrelevant deformation just wants to turn on and completely destroy the ADS asymptotics and just give you nonsense. And I should point out that this instability is not there in the Proco-Lagrangian embedding of the Lifshitz solution.
So when you say possible, I mean, do you have the time-dependent solution? Are you saying that you don't yet have the time-dependent?
No, I haven't worked out these fluctuations in the background with some arbitrary time dependence. That's really what you need to do. And you need to see that there's some complex omega in the upper half plane that is a normalizable mode. And then you know there's an instability.
You just need to see
some growing. Yeah. I mean, one growing that you'd expect in like half coefficient 6.2 C is one that, that breaks spatial translation invariance and makes sort of stripes in space. I don't think anyone's found that yet, but it wouldn't be surprising if in one of these theories you got something
sure.
like that.
Yeah. Well, I should point out that in ADS, you know that frequency and momenta dependence in the wave equation always drop out at large radius. So I might suspect that something similar will happen here, but I just don't know.
Yeah, so then that's a prerequisite.
If that was, yeah, if it was, if it wasn't that, then it, I have no idea.
Are you running out of candidates for the infrared because you don't? I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know, and we haven't even been able to numerically build these things at finite temperature, so it's a mystery. Some of Steve Gubser's students have worked on trying to do some matching shooting. You shoot from the horizon and you shoot from infinity. You try to make them match, but I don't know how robust that is. All right, so I should mention some of the other cases. There was that other bound. If you're not really working in a large charge regime, then the only infrared fixed point we can find analytically disagrees with the numerics. It also doesn't have a shooting parameter, so we just don't know what the solution there is. At Q equals 0, you have a neutral scalar field, you can actually exactly solve the differential equation for chi and for phi, but you can find a non-analytic shooting parameter, but tuning the shooting parameter doesn't let you find the solution that has a VEV without a source. I don't know if that's just an issue of me needing to do the numerics more carefully or if this really isn't the solution, but it's, I mean, you can really just solve the differential equation for these guys exactly in that case. So.
You might mention that we have an analytic solution for the entire solution, right?
Yeah.
The horizon, which does seem to agree with the temperature.
That's right. It agrees with the low temperature solution. You just can't match it onto the boundary. Didn't include plots of that, but it does agree surprisingly well. So what have we seen? We see that this appearance of a gap is really just due to, you know, quote, gap, is just due to WKB suppression because you have to tunnel through some big potential barrier. There's never a hard gap. I should point out that most of the string embedded models, Q is of order 1, which tells us that the real part of the conductivity is really just some order 1 number, not some WKB suppressed number, you know, WKB suppression factor times omega to the delta. And that's what they saw in these string embedded models of charged scalar condensation. They didn't see a hard gap. They just saw some power law behavior at small frequency, which matched onto a different power law behavior at high frequency. And it's surprising that even in this minimal model, you can find some emergent symmetry in the infrared. You don't always find a full conformal symmetry, but you can at least find, for instance, Poincaré symmetry without scalar invariance. So there are a lot of open questions. For instance, can we contrive a model with a hard gap? I don't know. I mean, there are lots of models. You can very easily write down a Lagrangian, and then you have to go through the effort of figuring out what the infrared fixed point is, and then does it have a hard gap or not. Right, that's like making a list of all of the field theories there are. There are a lot of them. You can ask, well, what do charged fermions do in this hairy black hole background? You know that when you study the two-point of charged fermions in the Reisman-Nordström background, there's this appearance of some sort of non-Fermi surface. You can ask, well, what happens in this hairy black hole background? For instance, if this is the fermion that's some supersymmetric pair to the charged scalar that's condensed. So that's something that Gary and I are working on with Thomas. You can also ask, what happens if you try to form some hair on a horizonless geometry like a confining vacuum? What is it going to look like then? You know then you'll have a discrete spectrum, but you can still ask, what is the phase space of the system look like? And then the really, really hard question is, how can we make ADS CMT more realistic? And that is the really open question. And I'll close just with a new version of that diagram I had at the beginning of the parameter space. So again, we have Q squared and lambda. So this blue region was where we know the instability is. This pink regime is where we have the large charge solution, where you have Poincaré symmetry restored in the infrared. This orange line is the charged soliton, which is also just the z equals 1 limit of the Lipschitz solution. And the yellow region is the Lipschitz solution, which is really unstable, so maybe I should have made it red.
What's the difference between z equals 1 Lipschitz and ADS?
There isn't. My point is that it's connected to Lipschitz, so you move over here and it is ADS, right? It's ADS with a charged hair sitting on top of it. And this region down here, we know there's an instability. We can numerically find low temperature solutions. We just don't know what the analytic infrared solution is. So it would be nice to know what goes there. It should be a good question mark.
I mean, there's just no scaling guess for the horizon that works.
The scaling guesses that we had didn't work. And they didn't even match the numerics except exactly at Q equals 0. All right, thank you.
Can I ask you about this tiny little triangle in the bottom?
Here or
on the left there.
Here? This?
Yeah. So in the Deneff Hartnell paper, they plot this, they have this picture and they have temperatures.
Yeah.
For the instability. And they have temperatures for that region there. Do you have any comment on that?
I would have thought not.
It seems like that there's an instability in that
triangle. Inside the triangle? I would have thought not. I mean, right, in terms of what's happening in the bulk theory, it doesn't matter which lambda you pick. It's just a question of what the mass squared is. And if you look at the effective mass in the infrared regime, when you're in this region, this linearized argument tells you that you don't expect an instability.
Sure.
This isn't completely robust. This is a linearized calculation. I don't know exactly what they did.
Okay. I think there might still be an instability in that region. Interesting checking out. I not from this, but from
something else. I can believe that. This is purely just looking at what the effective mass of the scalar field is in the ADS2 cross R2 throat.
Questions?